All right, we're going to get started. Thank you all for coming. Appreciate it. Welcome to Elaine's. My name is Jeff Higgins. This is my wife, Cynthia's restaurant. We're Alexandrian cuisine, so it's Middle Eastern with French and Greek influences. And thank you for ordering some food and drink. It keeps us in business. We've turned this into a literary salon. So I've interviewed over 100 authors at this point. I haven't counted recently. We've had a lot of New York Times bestsellers. We've had local authors, politics, children's books, thrillers, which is what I write. You know, so a whole host. So if you like what you're doing, please tell your friends and we hope to see you again. Today, I'm excited about this interview. It should be a lot of fun. We have Mike Heinrich here. Mike attended K-12 schools and started his teaching career in New Kent County, Virginia, where he was inspired to be a teacher by a teacher. He studied history and math at Roanoke College, earned a master's in international education from George Washington University, and served in the U.S. Peace Corps in Vanuatu in the South Pacific. Mike and his wife met at a bereavement camp serving kids who lost a parent on September 11th, and they are the grateful parents of an amazing 13-year-old who is good at life and school. That comes to sort of an applause. Mike has taught a variety of subjects and served students of all backgrounds over the last 21 years, and he's been named Teacher of the Year in 3 different times and has earned co-state and district distinctions. Teacher Boy is Mike's first publication, so please welcome Mike. So it's great to have you here. First off, congratulations on the book. Writing is one of those things where everyone thinks they can do it, and then they sit down to write it, and they realize how hard it actually is. So congratulations.
Thanks a lot, Jeff. I hope that applies to me. I'm still not sure I learned how to write yet. But yeah, it was a great process. And thank you, Jeff, to you for Jeff has a very impressive career as a national hero. On the national level, he's also an accomplished author, and even after all that, continuing to celebrate, reading and writing. So we really appreciate the opportunity.
This is my joy. It's fun talking to writers and hearing the passion in writing, and for you, the passion in subject matter as well in teaching. Why don't you just give us a little bit? What is Teacher Boy about?
Yeah, so Teacher Boy started in a non-dramatic way. I was, at a large high school, and I was asked to do more and more for the staff, to help young staff. And I still had that 16-year-old excitement/insecurity about what can I offer? What's my formula? How do you write this down in bullet points to really help people? And I really struggled with that. So that's sort of where Teacher Boy started for me, was to lean on my experience to try to garner some confidence from all I had been through and then impart that to other teachers, which was very difficult. Teacher Boy is, really my love letter and thank you to educators, to all the family and friends and cousins that maybe didn't like school. It's a call for educators to be better for society. And it's also a thank you note to all the kids and families I got to serve. Certainly learned more and got more from the field than I've given. And I feel like I've given a lot, but we have a lot of educators in the room. Teacher Boy is an attempt to catalog that the craft and working with young people and their parents and families fill you up just a little bit more for you to keep going. So,
well, I'd love to hear that. Both my parents were teachers, so it's near and dear to me. So you're doing a couple of things here. You're tackling subject matter, but it's also memoir. So I got to ask you, how does it feel? Because just writing a book itself is kind of scary. How scary is it when you're writing memoirs? You're actually writing about your life and exposing yourself to the general public. And it's a wide variety of people who read the book, right? How did that feel?
Yeah, correct. So when I was writing it, it took me about 5 years to write. And it really wasn't like, I'm going to write a book now and I'm going to publish it and force it upon my friends and family to read it. It was really sort of a glorified journal. It was diary. It was therapeutic. It was a kind of a hobby, and it became more than that. So that was sort of how it started. That's a really great question, Jeff, because one of the things I've done, especially as a teacher, you are a public servant. And by the way, disclaimer, even though it says it right in the title, Teacher Boy, I don't pretend to be a mouthpiece for all teachers. This is just my story, my experience, because I respect them so much and because we're such a diverse sector of the population, in spite of stereotyping. So I wanted to make sure that I honored that. But also, I was in my mid to late 40s when I hit the publish button. So as a teacher, you're a public bureaucrat. You have to stay objective. You have to stay professional. You're not supposed to put too much personal detail out there because you are a servant. You're a humble servant for for the taxpayer and their kids, not for you. That said, this was an indulgent personal project. And when I hit that publish button, I'm not very good at this in life, but I told myself, this is a leap of faith. This is the courage that artists and struggling artists for since the beginning of time have struggled with, and saying, I'm going to try to put this out here and let the chips fall where they may. And surprisingly, once I got to the precipice of that leap of faith, it was far easier than I thought it would be to actually say, what the heck, let's do it. And that's how good I felt about the story that I tried to craft through my career. The other thing though, too, Jeff, I didn't know anyone would read it. I mean, I wanted to print a couple copies out for the nightstand, maybe, you know, for posterity, you know, for my daughter to have one day, just to kind of crystallize my whole career. And so it's been a really good year, and I've had a lot more readership than I thought, which has been exciting and a little nervous, but that's been really exciting.
I mean, it does take a lot of bravery. And for anyone who doesn't think that, take your journal at home and post it online tonight and just see how that feels once you hit send. I mean, it's scary, right? Because you get feedback from people, and you don't know if anyone's going to read it. If they read it, you don't know if they're going to like it. They don't know. I mean, it's an insight. All writing is personal, but it's certainly personal when it's memoir.
Correct. And there's a few folks in the room that have written really glowing reviews. So I think one thing that happened with me is that I was at peace with it, even if it didn't resonate with folks. Then a few early reviews from family, from friends, from strangers that somehow found the book put even more wind in this, in my sails, that, okay, if it resonates with one person outside of my family, it's already been worth it. So that was a very comforting thing about the process as well.
So beyond that, with the personal stories that you're revealing and the insight into what's happening behind your eyes, right? You also are writing something, so you're showing the craft of writing out there. Did you have any apprehension about putting out for your first book? I know you did, because all writers do. So is your debut, how did that feel with your first writing and putting that out for scrutiny?
Yeah, that was... it's interesting because the writing process for me paralleled my teaching career in a way that I didn't foresee, and I could kind of see it in the rearview mirror after it was done. I was very nervous about it. I mean, I've written, I think I'm, you know, I write emails, I do some professional writing in the school space. So I was kind of concerned, like, is my writing, you know, good enough or high enough level in grammar and syntax? I worked with one editor a few years ago, just to kind of see if I was on the right track. So that was definitely scary, but for better or worse, it's really like out of my control. It's not a conscious choice, but I felt good about the writing because I know it sounds corny, but I led with my heart and my authenticity. And that's kind of with the teaching craft and how this whole thing started. Like, I can't put the formula of what makes a good teacher on paper. And so the stories, I was hoping that the anecdotes I shared with my readers, that the emotional connection that a teacher can sometimes make with the students they serve might surpass syntax or grammar. I wanted to get it all right, but that's what was most important to me, was illustrating the truth in those moments that stood out in my career.
I think that honesty comes through. I mean, that's, people can sense it even in fiction. They can sense it when people are talking about real emotions, because you're looking for that universality, right, where people can connect to something that they can also, even if they haven't experienced it, they can understand it. I mentioned in your introduction that you had a teacher who inspired you to be a teacher. Who was that?
Yeah, my 10th grade history teacher, Mr. Cox, New Kent High School. I was actually able to connect with him through the book. So we actually made the TV news down in Richmond in the fall. They interviewed Mr. Cox and I, and he came to a book a signing and event there as well. So, yeah, I mean, I know we have a lot of educators in the room. I mean, I wasn't a bad student. My parents, who are here, essentially made me comply. You know, B was kind of the standard. So B or higher was good. I brought home some C's. I brought home some D's in middle school. And as a ninth grader, I still felt like I wasn't a super rebellious kid, but internally I was kind of rebellious. I was just doing the chore to get enough grades to kind of not piss anybody off. And, Mr. Cox came in the very first day. I mean, I was 15, and he said, we're not going to use the textbook. A lot of your education, even though you're in the advanced class, you're filling in the right blank, you're bubbling in the right multiple choice. We're really going to talk about, you know, history from an empathetic human point of view and drill down into the stories. So he made it very relatable. I mean, I told him he really could and should be an author, and in a way he is, even if he hasn't written it down on paper yet. And Mr. Cox, so I had him for 2 years. I got out of the advanced track so I could have him again as a junior. He drove me out to college one fall break, which was great. We traveled to D.C. together in my early 20s and kind of revisited some of the things we had talked about in his American history class. So, you know, he kind of remained a mentor for me. But he really made it feel real, and he cared. And I'll be honest, I told him, I said, I can't remember many of the facts that you taught us. You know, they're there for a while. They're there until the end of the unit test. And, you know, they kind of fade and make room for the next unit of study. But his essence, his presence, his urgency, and his care for us. I mean, he wasn't like a flowery, touchy-feely, oh, how's it going today, Mike? That's kind of my brand, for better or worse. But we could tell he cared for us. And I did write one. I wrote an essay about a couple family members. And he actually asked about them by name, like a month later. And I just thought he was doing it for a grade or for completion or did you write an essay? And he actually asked about my cousin Scott. And how's he doing? And cousin Scott was a terrible student in high school. He's more successful than any of us now, I think, or many of us in the room professionally. But he asked about cousin Scott. How's he going? He's a junior now, right, in high school. Oh, okay, so, you know, he's 2 years ahead of you. What's he thinking? So that really meant a lot to me that he remembered that more than the grade I got on the paper.
So he inspired you to do better in school, take it more seriously. He brought those subjects alive, but was his actual, the way he presented it, and you're talking about the authenticity for him too, like that you try to bring as a writer now, was it that the process, the technique that he used, is that what first got you interested, or later did you think, oh, I want to do that too? And if you told us a little closer, it'll...
Yeah, sure. No, not really the process, totally the essence. Totally the personal. Remember the TV show Survivor? You know, he said, okay, you guys watch Survivor. And he would bait us. Oh, yeah, Survivor. And that one person, he got kicked off. And he said, I'll tell you about a real Survivor. How about this Russian sub that just sank to the bottom of the sea? And they were alive down there for 20 hours. And they know they're not coming back up. That's Survivor. And then we'd read an article. Then we would discuss it. Then it's, what would you do? Who would you write? What would you say? And so he was shoving those crossroads of history and the human struggle right into our face through the content. So he took the curricular bullet point of the state, but he shoved it right in our lap and said, you have to struggle with this. You have to wrestle with this. What would you do? So it was very rigorous and demanding, while at the same time open-ended and personal. And there was essentially no wrong answers. As long as you contemplated that deeply, that's what checked his box.
And what was it at that time, like when you were taking the classes, that the idea of teaching came to you? Or is this something later when you remembered him, or as your relationship with him developed as when he was your mentor?
It was in class, and I write about this in the book. So I had a good friend of mine who I had known since third grade. Terrible student. He had hated school from third or fourth grade. I wasn't a very good student, struggled with reading, a lot of tears at home. And I would do my homework really quick. And his mom was helping him at the babysitting table, and he was struggling. And so Mr. Cox pulled him up to the front of the room. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, here we go. Mr. Cox is going to berate this kid. He's going to embarrass him. He's going to make a negative example of him. And he, pardon me, Jeff, sorry, I should have asked consent first in 2025. He grabbed the kid by the shoulder and shook it in a loving way and said, he doesn't like to write, but he wrote, and I'm proud of him. And we all gave him an ovation. We clapped. So I was like, if he can relate to a student that hates school, that was the transportable moment where I was like, I want to do that. Whatever that vibe he just created in the classroom with a very small gesture, he didn't have a bunch of laminated posters. It wasn't a perfect PowerPoint. He wasn't quoting the greats of history. He just made a human connection right there. And I was like, I want that. The feeling I have under my skin, the goosebumps I just got, the round of applause, I want to facilitate that for other people. And another theme in Teacher Boy is that I'm, no offense to anyone here, you know, I'm lucky to have had cousins, uncles, friends growing up, like we all did, that really hated school. And I know that a stereotype of education, and there might be some truth behind it, is that many of us who are educators liked school or did well in school. And that was me. I was a good, well-rounded kid. I was an athlete. I had good enough grades. So school was kind of not, my dad was a teacher. So I kind of just liked it. You know, I felt like it was a comfortable place. But for a lot of our students, they don't feel that way. So ironically, the poor academic students and family members I have are the ones I keep in mind the most. And how am I serving them? How are they receiving me? It's all about the user experience. So it can't just be someone that already likes school and is ready to learn. It's actually quite the opposite. So if we can get that far with kids that academics isn't natural for, I also wanted to chase that thread as well, like Mr. Cox did.
I can't tell you how many authors I've interviewed who's had that one person in their life, right, who was a mentor or somebody that inspired them. You've taught for 21 years. Have you ever had a student come back and talk to you about this? Did any of your students go into teaching or any of them inspire them in other ways and other endeavors?
Yeah, for sure. So this is my 26th year, 21 here in Fairfax County nearby. But yeah, 26 overall. I've had a number of students, it was right after COVID. I had a couple kids who were seniors in high school and were thinking about education. And I made a joke at back to school night every year with the parents. I said, and I taught 10th grade history, just like Mr. Cox. So I said, hey, my 10th grade history teacher inspired me to be a teacher, and I'm going to try my hardest not to do that to your kid. Okay. But nonetheless, yeah, I've had a host of students that are teaching now, and they've reached out to me a couple years ago. I had, you know, coffee and lunch with a former student who was thinking about going into high school teaching. And so that's been, you know, very special. I've gotten old enough now where there's a handful of my former students are teaching in my current school district. So now they're on the distro list, so I can find them and write them and, you know, ask them, hey, what'd you do for this warm up and things like that. So it's been fun to stay connected with them.
What's that feeling like when you have a student come back and they've gone into teaching and they did it because of you?
Yeah, it's pretty gratifying. Pretty gratifying. And then, and the ones that have, except for maybe one, are flourishing and doing really well. So it's beyond gratifying.
You mentioned your book a little bit about your idealism not necessarily being accepted in certain places. And how has your idealism, like when you first started and coming from this great mentor that you had and this teacher that you wanted to emulate, how did that change over 26 years?
Well, that's a great question. We were just talking about this at the end of the table down there. So I think I'm trying to think of a good metaphor here, but yeah, my idealism, you know, the world was like a blank slate. I started teaching when I was 21 in the fall of 1998. So the world was a blank slate. I assumed that school had not taken place before I got on the staff. And, you know, it was my fresh start, and I was just going to teach on this blank slate in front of me. And so you get like your first cut or your first scar, even if you try hard and it doesn't work out. Or you try really hard and it goes well for a while. You sustain goodness for a while and then something still falls out. So that's really the lesson there. The cadence was that you have to continue to recharge and reclip your idealism. That is the craft. I thought, oh, I have a finite amount of idealism and I hope I can retire before it runs to empty. But it's really more of a jumping up and down and dealing with reality in a healthy way is probably the biggest thing teaching has taught me.
I mean, well, that's interesting, right? Because everyone deals with that in some respect, whether it's in their relationship or with their job. How do you reconcile the differences between the real world when it slaps you in the face and what you thought it should be? And like, what are the techniques you use as a teacher to kind of reevaluate and change your approach?
Right. Well, some of it's not being like, that's a great question, Jeff. I don't know what else to do. I mean, I think call it hope, call it idealism. You're worn out. I mean, I had a really rough spring last spring. I had a series of four pretty rough events that took place in my orbit around the school. And so, you know, it sounds trite and simple, but, you know, you keep showing up. And so when you're there and you're dressed and you don't want to be there consciously, but it's like, what the hell else am I supposed to do? You know, and if this is on fire, there's probably three other students that have not had the support of the school that are still out there waiting. So, I mean, that's difficult. It's a metaphor, you know, for my daughter to keep getting back on the horse. And it's not real conscious. And again, I wish I could take credit and say, look how tough I am. I'm so good. I can keep going. I would take credit if that was it, but it's more just an innate thing of like, well, dang, I mean, what else are you going to do? That's really the unconscious choice that I think strong educators, just that engine they have built in.
Well, I love the work ethic and showing up and just being there and powering through it. But you mentioned, like, you know, refilling your tank, mm-hmm. right? As your idealism gets worn away. What are there certain techniques you do within the day to like, you know, some successes, or do you take the time to celebrate the victories, or what is it you do to kind of rejuvenate yourself?
Yeah. So the last 5 years, I was a behavior interventionist at a large high school with a lot of students that I call academically insecure. And I wasn't always good at this for myself. I mean, there's some elements in Teacher Boy where I'm not great at hitting the reset button for myself as well. Kid, you know, a kid comes into the office, or you've been tasked with this list of students. And so they, unfortunately, even at 14, 15, 16, they perceive, and they might have a tangible list of negatives that have littered their consciousness about themselves. Their self-perception is negative. How's school? It sucks. What do you think about this teacher? Oh, no, they can only pick maybe one teacher that they don't hate. And so I spent a lot of time with them literally writing down, like assessing their assets and naming their assets that they had. You know, Jeff, this is hard to hear, Jeff. It sounds like it's rough. I really like how you move in the hallway. You move pretty smooth. We got a lot of immaturity out there. You're chilling. You look good. Like you're not letting things get to you. And pointing out things that they might not see in themselves was the biggest thing I had. Another inspiration for Teacher Boy, I had students make a timeline of their life, especially if they were suspended for 3 days. I was looking for meaningful ways to connect with them. And so I stumbled upon, and it was an old history assignment that I used, where the kids could make a timeline of their life. And again, you're going to stumble upon some rough memories, some trauma, and that's a scary space to be in. And I would tell them right up front, you can put whatever you want. You don't have to put anything, you know, deep and dark if there's something there. And so they would put the events in their life, and many of them were positive. And even though they weren't feeling positive, I would say, well, look at this. And then the last thing I did with that, you know, so they're 16 or 17, then I would draw that timeline out to a blank, to 80 years or 78 years, and say, look at all this you have left. So, you know, the scale of what you've been through and this cycle that you're in, how can we make the rest of that line? What are some things you can do? And then they would generate, and I would help them generate responses to what they could see for themselves in the future, and that this good or bad, what they're going through at the moment was temporary.
How difficult is that to talk about, like, long range planning or putting things in perspective with someone whose brain isn't even fully developed, right? And they're looking in the moment. Like, how difficult is that to give them that, like, 40,000 foot view?
It was pretty difficult. I mean, the kids were generally open to it. I mean, it was their chance to kind of dream. You know, I'm trained in restorative justice as well. So I had a bank of questions. You know, if money was no object, what would you do with your life? For example, what would you want to do? Where do you picture living? So I had tiered questions and an interview cadence with them that would kind of fill in some of those blanks for them. But it certainly was difficult. I mean, another thing I think we lose track of with teachers when we look at outputs and results is that I don't want to sound like Matt McConaughey here, but, you know, we have our story as individual educators, but the students we face are new every year, and they're adolescents, they're early adolescents. So their impulses, their vision or lack thereof is always temporary. And I even think about me from age 16 to 26, I was an entirely different person, as I imagine many of us were. So that's another thing. I hope that outside society sees teachers that way. And I hope we teachers see ourselves that way, that we are ushering young adults through an important but largely temporary stage. And that whatever they disclose or share or feel, thankfully, in 3 months, their brain will change and they might have different goals. And I'm also grateful to work in a school district that has a lot of resources for kids to build tangible plans about their future. And I know not all places in the country have that, but thankfully we do in this area.
So beyond like the physiology and those challenges that all kids have, you also only have them for maybe a class, right? And the teachers as a whole, you only have them during the day. And so they're going home to various backgrounds and challenges at home and families that may or may not care about learning or school or not have books in the home. Because I hear there's a movement now, right? To like, you know, let's hold teachers accountable based on how effective they are. But how effective can you be when you just have the kids for this little slice of time and they have all these other influences?
Yeah, another great question. So as a teacher, whether I'm not smart enough to see that scale, you know things are going on. But my approach was I want to be a benign, consistent, positive force in their life. And I've always cycled into they've got this going on. The odds are stacked against them. And my empathetic heart would bleed for them. It would wear me out. I would bring it home. I would be despondent at home, living adjacent to a young person's story that was, you know, getting to me and eating away at me. So trying to, without being cold, compartmentalize and just say, I can control what I can control. I mean, that was the mindset that you have to bring, because you're right. The other part about, you know, equity and understanding is that you don't know what a student's going through. So a good rule of thumb for me was not to assume that every single kid was going through some great trauma, but maybe some of them were. So to treat them with kid gloves, to approach them with the respect and dignity that we all deserve. And if you just come in hot, where's your homework? This is the second day it's late. You're asking for a negative interaction. So I always approach kids, I didn't drop my expectations of them, but it was always a personal touch and an understanding that I don't know where they're coming from. I don't know what they saw and heard this morning or last night. I don't know what they ate or didn't eat last night. So I'm just going to make this as smooth and positive as I can. And that worked for all kids, even the kids with a lot of assets and resources. That approach, I didn't have to differentiate. For all the other instructional differentiation you have to do, that emotional approach, I didn't have to differentiate and work for everyone.
So your books have a lot of experiences, and you're also talking about different techniques and things. What do you find to be the most, and you've talked a little bit about it, but what are the most like effective techniques or things that people think are effective that just don't work at all in reality, right? There's always that expectation because something's always been done, but teachers who are there on the front lines know it doesn't work.
Yeah, so the education field, like other sectors, continues to try to update itself and refresh itself with the next best thing, the next great acronym, the next reading program that's scripted that we have to shove down the kids and teachers' throats. So that has always been, and again, that was one of my early scars. You know, I thought I went to a training and it was like, wow, this is the future of teaching. And then 2.5 years later, there was another future of teaching that, you know, abandon everything that you've learned and this is it. And there's data from one small school district from 7 years ago that put it in a journal that was at a conference that your principal went to, and now you're subject to that for the next 2 or 3 years until the next thing came around. So that's really at the heart of Teacher Boy. I really liked, you know, we were taught for a while that lecturing is bad, at least teaching high school history. I didn't like to lecture long. But a good lecture isn't bad. So I like to be prepared with direct instruction for a small fraction of the day to really tell the kids and to show them that you're prepared to have a joke or two, to have a metaphor or two, to have a picture or two, to let them know, hey, I was ready to serve you and honor you with this presentation. And again, I don't want to get into nuts and bolts. That might be 8 minutes. That might be 12 minutes or 15 mm-hmm. minutes, but they're going to get bored soon after. And then I really wanted to inject student voice and choice. So the more years I taught, my first year teaching, everyone did the same worksheet to review that skill. I mean, I didn't have the preparation. I stole a worksheet from a teacher, and all 150 of my students are doing the same thing. Cause geez, I've made copies. Thank God the copier was working. That's it. Then year two, I would have that assignment, but I had time to look at it again and say, okay, maybe I can change this one or save this, and I can do another activity that scratches the same curricular itch. And eventually I had like 7 or 8 or 10 things. And so I could give the kids a menu of options. Like, you can make a video showing these 4 things with your friends. You can make an audio recording podcast. You can do the daggone worksheet and just be left alone for the next 20 minutes. Whatever works for you, you could write a story. So I liked giving the kids choice with the third rail still being the curriculum they had to cover, but they could express it any way they chose.
So how do you balance between like reaching out to children in a way that they might be more open to the curriculum or be more open to expressing themselves like through a video or something, but also then not having people fall back on the things they're already good at? Like how do you get them to learn these new skill sets too? Like is there an equilibrium there that you're looking for?
I think the equilibrium, I mean, I still haven't found it in 26 years. I mean, especially when you have 150 personalities, it's kind of a constant dance. I mean, my approach, and again, this is just mine, was usually less is more. And I liked being honest with the kids. I think that we think sometimes we can't be honest with them. Kids don't like an audience. I know that. So speaking to anyone, adolescent or otherwise, individually, and speaking my truth from a place of authenticity and saying, hey, you know, Marianne, I love having you in class. You're doing fine. How is this going? Or is there something I can do? Or I think you have more. What do you think about that? Is that fair? Am I pressing? Am I doing too much? Marianne, tell me. And that opens the kid up. And you can't ask them that around their friends. You have to ask them that individually and build a little trust. But the kids are very strong and resilient. I think they got it, and I think they appreciated it.
You talk in the book a little bit about like the pandemic and the effect it had on you as a teacher, but also on students. What are we seeing? I mean, I know it's so recent, but are we seeing any of like the kind of long lasting effects that came from that distance learning?
Yeah. So in my career, so I was in the classroom for my 20th year, and then I took a job as a behavior interventionist. So I actually left instructional teaching to become this kind of student support mentor person for them. Then the pandemic hit 7 months into that tenure. A couple of things. First off, during the pandemic, I know at my current school or at my previous school, we made a lot of efforts to do outreach to make sure the families were still doing okay, if they need anything. I mean, I was down here on Route 1 in the trailer park trying to install the MiFi internet devices and things. I had the Cox guy on the phone, and I, you know, it looks like it might be an HDMI. I'm not sure, you know. And there was a lot of other, you know, outreach where the school hopefully was trying to get to them. When the kids came back, that was difficult. So I was in a relatively new role, and I think it's gotten slightly better. But we had a lot of difficulty the first year back. I think students were used to being pent up at home, what they wore, what time they woke up, hours on their phone, maybe not having an adult in their life for a year or more that was really there to kind of guide their day or help them schedule or take direction. So that was really difficult, as well as instructionally. I mean, I think we extended, and it's piecemeal, it's a patchwork across the country and across the state, what schools did what schools required what of students. But generally speaking, you know, the term learning loss certainly was real. And that's still out there in the ether. I know we have a lot of educators in the room. You know, I don't know how you guys feel about that or not. But generally speaking, the loss of structure and some loss of instruction was definitely felt. I know at the high school level, we had a lot of, and no, you know, we high school teachers can sometimes indulge by blaming the middle school, feeder school. Oh, they don't prepare them. They're too nice. They play trivia games, and you know, so they're never ready for math in ninth grade, according to high school teachers. But that I think became more pronounced, or maybe a little more legitimate. Some of those harder skills, there's definitely been kind of a deficit, a flat line, if you will, the last few years.
Yeah, I've seen some numbers, but do you know like how much, what kind of deficit we're looking at from like test scores and things from the as a result of that pandemic and the distance learning?
I don't know.
So I have a question for you, and this is something I'm just curious, but it seems like in education, when you take like you create this sort of artificial cohort and you have these kids same age and they're together all the time, and it's so unlike the rest of life, right? Where you're at home and you have, you know, three or four generations and neighbors and people like that. Do you find that's effective, having people all at the same age, because they're in the same kind of the same sort of learning challenges at that age? Or is it something where if maybe it was a little more intermingled? So I know some schools do that, right, where they have older kids and they spend time together. What are your thoughts on
that? Yeah, so I feel like, Jeff, if I have another book in me, you're getting to what I hope I can write about one day, or maybe if I have a second episode of my career, it would be around this. So you're so right. Whatever your age is and where you live, okay, come on in. There's your hard plastic seat. You're going to sit in it from August until the following June, no matter what. Students that could finish a class by February still have to sit in the blue plastic seat. Students that might need 14 months to show the same standards, they're on the same timeline. So I'm excited. I'm cautiously optimistic about the future of education because I do think it could and should be more flexible. The last number of years I've worked with juniors and seniors that are at risk of dropping out. And ironically, what we do with them, and I think it's good, at least in the county I teach in now, is that we do have options. None of them are perfect, but a student can enroll in an online class. I worked with two yesterday. I'd never met them before. Do you like this better than your regular class? Yes. Why? I hated my teacher, or the people in the class were annoying, or it was really hard. I got to start the class over again. It's February. I've skipped 60% of the class periods. I'm lost. So I'm going to start fresh. So having models like that, now you can't give the students too much leash because some of them might take it and not and run with it. But I think that's a really good way. And we also underestimate what the kids have been through. So if they're 16, 17, 18, they've been through school for a decade. And even though some of us like to think we know what's best, we are the adults in the room. Hey, you need to do this. We know what's best. They've got 10 years. That's not nothing. I mean, from 5 to 15, they know what school's about. They've heard all the things. They've read all the teacher notes. They've gotten the phone calls home. So we don't want to give the game to the kids, but I think there's a huge range of potential there for flexible credit acquisition. And I don't want to get too dreamy with the group. It'd be a difficult book to write because of all the research, but I can see schools having anchor days, perhaps, but then also becoming more of like a community learning center, like a library where perhaps, Jeffrey, you have to log 15 to 25 hours in classes, traditional classes, but maybe the other 10 or 15, if you're trustworthy and can work virtually, like much of the adult world does, maybe you can. Or maybe you can go to the school building, but be in the cafeteria with a few tutors. So making the day more flexible, and we waste a lot of human capital on the kids' side and also on the adult side, herding these 21st century cats into the classroom. Every freaking bell that rings, we've got 150 or 200 students that, oh, well, you had 8 minutes to take the class, but I'm going to take a ninth minute. I'm going to take a 10th minute. And we literally hammer them every day. Come on, let's go. Let's move. Let's walk and talk. Let's walk and talk. And now again, some of that's age appropriate. Some of that, they're just going to milk it as far as they can. But I think we can better meet that and make learning not so compliance-driven and more welcoming to the students. And they can work at their own pace. And that goes for both students that need help, more help than most, and students that could accelerate a lot faster.
So when you talk about like individualized teaching like that and letting people move at different speeds and go sort of like a Khan Academy, right? Like type of model. When you have that, do you think because it is manpower intensive, it's more costly. Do you think that maybe with artificial intelligence, this is something that will change the model of how this is done and make it more effective?
I think it definitely can. And I think it already has. I think we're kind of on the horizon of that. I know that my seventh grade daughter's math assessment test is AI generated already. And it literally reacts live to what her last answer was. So it keeps nudging her up a grade level and then she gets one wrong and it knocks it down. So I do think that's an exciting thing there. And it would be a big change of culture for teachers. I mean, that's the hard part. I mean, I'm a Gen Xer pushing 50, making that cultural adjustment. I've got colleagues, these Gen Z teachers, they would love to work at school from like 1 p.m. to 9 p.m. Some of our kids want 1 to 9. During COVID, I was the principal for our summer school. It was all online. I would log in at 7:30 sharp every day, dead. Not one assignment turned in. You know, then I'd start emailing kids. Then I'd get a few emails rolling in around lunch or one. Then, like at 10 p.m. to 3 a.m., the wire is hot. Everyone's online. Mr. Henrik, can you unlock this? Mr. H, can you? I submitted three things. Why can't I get it graded? It's only 2:15 a.m. I'll be up for a while, you know. So almost like flipping the clock. That was really enlightening for me as an administrator and as a, you know, kind of a person overseeing the program. So then I still woke up at 7 to check my email. Then I could have a day. I could have a morning. I could work out, have a coffee, walk the dog, whatever. Then I'd log in at 1 and check in. And then I knew my hot time was that 9 to 2, 9 to 3. We did a study as well at one high school, large high school. 33% of our students did worse online as far as engagement, showing up, attendance. But my principal and I were planning on building our own online school when the pandemic was over, which never took place because of political reasons. The governor at the time, we're back in school, our superintendent, we're back, everyone's back, COVID's over, we got to come back in person. We found that 25% of our students did better during COVID. I had a young lady who worked at Safeway and she was in class on her little AirPod. Now that's not ideal learning, but she was doing it. And then she would get her phone and fill out the little blanks the teacher said, and she would do her little responses and then continue to work for the money that her family needed. And so we had a lot of cases like that, students with anxiety and socialization issues and had been through a decade of school and just hated it. They did well online. They liked it. They liked turning their camera off. No one can see the face that I'm not proud of. No one can see the same hoodie I wear 15 days in a row. I've got the black box, but I'm going to fill up the chat. I'm going to turn my mic on and talk. So that worked for a lot more students than we thought.
I can see that working with people who have, like, you know, social anxiety and things, but maybe they're doing better academically, but then they're also missing the other component of the school, right, which is the socialization and being around other kids and everything. Do you find, like, in the distance learning that's something that kids have a harder time actually, like, relating to each other in person?
I think so. The kids are funny today. Well, two things on that, Jeff. So, you know, I, as I write in the book, I grew up in the 80s. So school was one of the major institutions of our life's experience, you know, going to school, whether you liked it or not. That's where the action was. That's where the information was. That's where the teachers and the rack of encyclopedias. That's where the knowledge was. So I have to be careful. That's my context I'm bringing to the table. These students today, you know, they grew up in the smart age. So all this factual knowledge they can find in the palm of their hand. I mean, these young people today have more knowledge than anyone else in the history of the world. They have more knowledge than Renaissance libraries 500 years ago. They have more knowledge that they can access than we did even 40 or 50 years ago. And socialization. As a Gen Xer, I feel like, dang, I want to go to school. Yeah, you know, scrape your knee on the playground. If you don't like that person, learn to avoid them or give them a piece of your mind. That's what we do. We stand up for ourselves. But, you know, the kids are obviously doing it in ways that I can't always relate to. They, you know, IG Messenger is a big way that they socialize. And so it is interesting that, I don't know if it's AI, Jeff, but are we moving to a post-technological society where they know each other more from their avatars on their social media apps than they do in real life, where they recognize each other in person? Like, oh, you're Hotbot 317 with the cars. That's cool. I didn't know you went here. So it alarms my Gen X heart to think that the physical school building and all the interactions that were so precious to me and my imprint on what school is, I don't want to irresponsibly project that on the next generation because whether they mean to or not, they're inventing new ways for society to bind. It is scary, though. I mean, I think I say it, I know I say it in the book near the end. I still want school to be the antecedent and the balm to some of the disconnection that we have in society. But I don't think we can just say, turn your phones off for the next 100 years. That's it. That's the standard. Although that's helped a lot, too. We are limiting cell phone use and things like that. So that's an interesting generational conflict that I really had contemplated in my writing and still do.
So generational, but it's also cultural, right? So there's a lot of that in people's like online presence or things you're maybe not going to be able to control because it's happening outside of school. But it's interesting you talk about like the different hours that kids work. I read a sleep study a few years ago. They were talking about based on the age, right? In the teenage years, kids should not be getting up at 6 a.m. and going to school. They need restorative sleep. Their brains are still healing and functioning and they're capturing their memories early in the morning, as opposed to like somebody who's like my age who starts getting up earlier and earlier, right? You know, right. So it is age dependent. So my question is, how much, because we have the science now, I mean, it's pretty clear cut. Like how hard is it to get like an institution to change that model when it's something they've been doing for like, you know, 150 years or whatever?
I mean, it feels like that's above my pay grade. You know, I enjoy daydreaming about what the future might be. And again, shifting the school building to be longer, maybe with less staff at any one given time. I don't know. I try to stay away from politics. I mean, it's not necessarily political, but I think it would be very difficult to change the culture within educational institutions and also the cultural norming of that for those outside. So I think I'm cautiously optimistic that there's change coming. I just hope it's for the good of the students and the educators and not for the headlines and the clicks.
Right. We've spent a lot of time on your subject matter because it's super interesting. But let's talk a little bit about the book itself. How long did this book take you to write?
The book took me around 5 years. Again, I started off not really thinking it'd be a book, but it took about 5 years. And the last year before I published, I think I could have published a lot quicker. I was spinning my wheels a bit, but yeah, about 5 years.
Yeah, welcome to writing. So, so did you, you mentioned the journals and you've been taking notes and writing things, a lot of it was therapeutic. When you said, okay, now this will be a book, did you sit down? Did you outline? Did you go through it? What was your process like?
Yeah, so I had a bunch of raw material. I had audio recordings. I had, you know, Google Doc kind of diary and things. And then I started to move. The book is largely chronological, but not entirely. So I tried to make my stories, I mined themes from throughout my career and tried to kind of push them together into sort of chapters. So some of the chapters are a straight up chronological chapter of my life, whereas others are more composite images of like a notion that I'm trying to get to the reader. So that was really, I used highlighter and like highlighted, like, you know, pink was for like touchy feely, deep reflection, and green was just action and funny stories, and yellow was more serious. And, you know, another color would be like, you know, family, personal stuff. And so I tried to kind of either have the chapters laced with one of each color, or sometimes I pushed all the same data into one chapter to make a point.
Were you aware of that, like pacing and cause you're doing both information that you're trying to provide to people, but you're also trying to couch it in story so it's entertaining. So doing that balance as you were writing, was that difficult?
Very difficult. The editing process was by far harder than the writing. You know, writing was fun at first, just the brain dump, just to get it all out there and just have fun. Like the environment I wanted to make for my students. Just go. Just say it. Mr. Cox, my teacher, just write. Just write. I don't care what it looks like. Just go. Go. Get the start. That was the fun part. But then editing it, sometimes you cut 60 or 70% of what you just wrote. So then making executive decisions about what was superfluous, what was redundant, which, by the way, is a never-ending process. It was difficult. And again, sometimes it was exciting the first run through. The first couple edits were exciting and fun, and then it started to feel like work. Well, I could leave this phrase in, or let me read it without it. And so it keeps you up at night, and that was kind of that struggling artist thing. I definitely hit my head against the wall a lot with the editing process.
Did you use any of the writing softwares out there, any of the AI stuff like ProWriting 8 or AutoCrit or any of those to help?
I didn't. I went straight to Microsoft Word. Yeah.
And did you set, like, as you're writing a book, because you're working full time, right? Did you set a certain time every day? Did you write to a word count, or how did you keep yourself self-motivated to get this book done?
Yeah, well, the people that have worked with me before have known me since I was, you know, born. They know I'm more of a type B personality. I like novelty, as everyone I think here knows. So I would get on a thread like, I'm going to write for 2 hours a day. And I would really be excited about it, kind of like going to the gym. And I would honor it. I would wake up at 4:30 or 5, and really do 2 hours, watch the clock and do 2 hours. And that was a good kickstart for me. After about 11 or 12 days of that, I would build some self-trust and say, okay, I'm burning out. I want to be structured, but I don't want to feel, I don't want this to feel like another job, and I don't want to resent the writing process. So I was torn between habit and still feeling like it was pure to me. And then there was another system where they would say, write for 2 4-hour blocks a week. You know, the internet, there's a million authors out there that have these little tips and what worked for them. And so I actually enjoyed leapfrogging around the different systems. I felt good enough. I trusted myself enough. I would always be connected to the book. But I didn't have a strict regimen for writing.
What was the hardest part or the most surprising part of the writing process for you?
Well, the writing process, again, is like teaching to me. So I would anguish over, do I write this or do I not? And there's still some things that got edited out that, you know, could it be a second book? I've saved them all, of course. They're still, you know, I still treasure some of that. The comfort I had was like a teacher. So when I'm teaching a lesson and I'm talking about a period of history, and I remember to tell the kids 4 of the 5 facts that they're supposed to know. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I did not tell my first period that 5th fact. Thankfully, and I'll get them the next time I see them, but thankfully they don't know I omitted that. It's actually kind of, you know, to me, it's like, oh, what a deficit there, man. They're going to, Mr. Henrik didn't teach us about that. I mean, they don't know what I didn't teach them. So that was liberating for me as a writer, that it mattered to me. Oh, should I put this in here? This is really important to me. But I did come to peace with, I'm presenting this and the reader has no real expectations. They're not going to know my omissions. They're just going to read the assets that's there. They're not going to be aware of the omissions that I perceive, which is liberating.
When you write, do you listen to music? Do you have a special place? A lot of people are very precious about this. Or can you write anywhere? You said you changed up your times a bit.
I changed up my times, but I did have like our guest room kind of got converted to my little writing headquarters. And I like to turn the lights off, and I had a candle. I never was a candle guy, but I did like to light a candle and write in the dark.
So why is that? Is it because you're blocking out all the distraction and you feel like you're by yourself or you can focus, or what was the reason behind it?
Yeah, I never thought of that consciously, but that was it. I felt like, and it's got a curtain for the door. It's not a swinging door. It's a curtain. So it's kind of like ethereal in there, and it's like, it gets real dark. And I just like, yeah, it was like a little hovel that I could lose time in.
Were you playing with a Ouija board in there? So there's a lot of pathways to publication. Well, what made you choose this one, and what were some of the challenges with it?
Yeah, so for anyone, you know, out there, I have stumbled through the self-publishing process. I queried a few traditional publishers early on, I think a dozen or so of them, and 2 of them wrote me back and liked the chapter I sent them, but still rejected my proposal or said thanks or it's good, or guess what, we have editors that will charge you a lot of money to work on this, which, and I'm not even poo-pooing that option. I mean, part of me thinks, wow, if I would have followed that fork in the road, I'm not sure where that would have taken me. I had a couple fellow teachers that are also self-published, and so they steered me to Amazon KDP, so Kindle Direct Publishing. It's a free account. It's a little bit of a clunky interface. I'm not a very high-tech guy. So they got me started there. So I did load the book on Kindle. So some of you who have bought the book have got the Amazon version. And I like how it turned out. And 90% of the online marketplace, I think for almost anything, but for books, from what I understand, is on Amazon. So people said, yeah, you can focus on traditional publishing. You can focus on Barnes & Noble or, you know, small bookstores. But 90% of books are purchased on Amazon. So that's the marketplace. It might not look like a bookstore, but it is the bookstore. So that was compelling enough. And the price tag being free, other than your time and labor. I had to spend a little money on the cover and things like that. I used Canva for the cover. I love Canva, too. And so Ready, Marianne? So I got a free trial for a month, and I had to put my debit card information in there. And then I made the cover, in like 10 days and I canceled it. So I didn't pay for Canva, but I used a free trial for the cover. So I liked Amazon for the online sales. And then once I had that out there, Barnes and Noble, it's called BN Press. They have a similar system just for them. So I kind of have a two-pronged thing going on right now with the book. Amazon is still live for online. And then Barnes & Noble Press, I really wanted more for the brick-and-mortar feel that they provide. There's 600 and some branches across the country. They just built 60 new branches post-COVID. We are claiming that the bookstore is back now, that people are getting out and buying books again. So I really wanted to kind of have that element for my promotion as well. So that currently that's where Teacher Boy is. Barnes & Noble, in-store and orderable, and also Amazon.
You know, I like the cover. It's good. I've seen some really bad self-published covers, and this one I think is really good. But there's a lot of, like, behavioral economics behind what drives consumer behavior, too. Did you do any research on, you know, what would the elements of a cover? Because it's difficult.
I did not, Jeff.
But it's great. I mean, it's honestly, it's one of the better self-published covers, I think. I mean, it's clear. It's easy to read. It looks professional. I like the line paper, right? It kind of gives you, because you have to look at it and kind of have an idea of what you're looking at. And you have memoir, you know, in there. Like, it's I like it. I think you did a great job with that.
Thank you, Jeff. I did have a vision of the cover, and I shared this with my dad a lot. I wanted, like, remember the old, like, the green leather grade books the teachers had? So I wanted to have, like, teacher in that, and then the bottom half be, like, a carved desk, like the kid, you know, with the pocket knife carved boy in there. And so I had that idea and I shared that with a couple friends that have some, you know, digital, like, visual stuff. And I think it cost some money. Like, it wasn't just a Canva or a Photoshop situation. So I liked that idea, but I really was pleased with this.
You can still use that in marketing. You can still do that for, like, your Facebook ads and for posters at craft fairs and things.
I like that.
So you have a 5-star rating on Amazon, which is really good, and, you know, in a bunch of reviews. What are you doing to market it, and what's working for you, and what do you think isn't working?
Yeah, so great question. I'm still roaming the entrepreneurial landscape, relatively lost, I'll be honest. I have found for my journey as the author that doing in-person events like this has given me the most reward, just the personal touch, kind of like, again, kind of paralleling to my career. I've paid for some Amazon ads, and then after 4 days of running like $9 or $10 a day ads, and maybe getting a sale or two, I get scared and then pull it. So I don't, you know, I'm using my personal social media. And I've got a few more appearances at Barnes & Noble's coming up. So for now, that's really my only strategy, is to kind of see if I still have the energy and the interest to book in-person events to get it out there. But that's pretty much it so far. I do have my own website. I paid for 3 years for a GoDaddy website, which is actually really user-friendly and good. And I've gotten some traffic there. It's still difficult. You can buy the book from the website, although very few people have, although it's getting a lot of hits. So I don't know if that's the internet lying to me or not. So I think people are at least touching that, which feels good. But that's pretty much it for now.
I mean, it's tough. It's a whole different skill set, right? From writing the book or from your subject matter expertise. It's a whole different area.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the classroom is there, right? So the bell schedule set up for you, the desk you didn't have to pay for. I had to decorate my walls and buy the kids food and snacks and stuff like that. But, you know, a lot of the infrastructure and teaching is there. And this has been an interesting thing for me as a longtime teacher. To kind of try to dabble into the entrepreneurial spirit of all that. And it's very much the Wild West. Experiences like this and others have been very warm. And then there's a lot of cold experiences. But, you know, compared to teaching, it's nothing. If someone says no or doesn't email you back, you know, oh, you know, man, I can't get into that store. I'm like, I don't care. They said no or didn't email me back. It's nothing.
You're used to rejection. Yeah. The heart is coming. All right, I'm going to come around. If anybody has questions, I ask you to hold the microphone close so we can, because we're going to, this will probably end up in a podcast or something later.
Okay.
Any questions? Yeah.
Love you, babe. Thanks.
Hi, Mike. My name's Jackie Norman. I'm just kidding. I've known Mike for years. I have to initially fangirl about the book. I think you captured the beautiful, complicated idea of education in a way that is unique and understood by educators. I've known you a long time, and yet what I loved about that book is that there were still things I had no idea about you. So there was this refreshing exposure that you allowed for yourself personally. So I'm grateful for the book in general and inspired by today. In regards to education, there's so much post-COVID that became, everybody had a view into the classroom. A lot of people who weren't in education had a view into the classroom and now still feel that they have the rights to whatever's going on in the classroom. So my question to you is, if you're trying to encourage educators to be in education, can you speak to a little bit about the trust that people used to feel that their classroom was their classroom, and now it feels very exposed? Technology, somebody's recording your class, somebody's taking a photo in your class, somebody's, can you speak a little bit about how that, the trust factor and how to still inspire people to go into that profession?
Yeah, sure, Jack. And I think one of the accidental things that my book, thank you, by the way, very much, Jack, I appreciate it. One of the things that I think the book has stumbled into, in my own heart at least, is it kind of became we're good enough to be trusted. And I didn't set out, when I started some of those early chapters, that was not really a big theme. I still had this 80s, 90s, early 2000s that the schoolhouse was one of the three or four pillars of society that people generally trusted or didn't know enough about to comment on. So it kind of lined up, unfortunately, with what I think is an eroding trust. Jackie, you know, inspire, I don't go out and try to inspire people to become teachers. I mean, I think the book, we definitely need them, as we all know. I mean, we have a shortage since COVID. And Jeffrey, I didn't mention that before. You know, we lost some students to COVID. We lost 10% of our teaching force the first year after COVID. So when schools reopened, we lost 10% more of teachers. And so, yeah, I mean, Jack, we definitely feel that, Jackie. And the hard part for me, just me personally, that I don't touch much in the book, you know, there are some voices in society and the media that are sticking their nose into education. They think they know everything. And I mentioned that in Teacher Boys, that because we were all students, all of us were students, that somehow qualifies them to then have some sort of sophisticated opinion that when you see it on a screen or on a tweet, it lines up equally with career educators when it really doesn't even belong in the same universe as a career educator. So that's frustrating. I'll be honest, I mean, the other hard part, it sometimes comes from the parents and the students. I mean, I've had students audio record me before if you're going in for a conversation. And so that's a little bit 1984-ish where you feel like, wow, not that you need me to be a protector, but I'm shielding my kids from some of the toxic noise and attention. That's my job now. One of the many roles that we take on that's not in any teacher handbook. We're supposed to teach the content, but we take on so many roles. We have to disclose suicides. We have to break up fights physically. We have to try to stop bullying before it starts. So I always thought, as a history teacher especially, I'm going to filter out the bombast and noise from the outside, and we're going to focus on what's important in here. But I think there's a small but growing undercurrent that we are not to be trusted, and even among some families and students. And that's difficult to swallow. And, you know, we're losing teachers to COVID. And I also lament testing. Like, I'm not afraid of standards. I'm not afraid of standards. But we punish our best teachers and our above average teachers with cramming standardization and testing down their throat. And it's taken the joy out of it. Even if you think of kids in high school like me who were potential teacher candidates, their school experience was full of cramming for standardized testing. I'll be honest, in the 80s and 90s, you know, school was tougher in some ways, and we walked uphill for 5 miles in the snow both ways to and from school and home. But we didn't have an SOL staring at us. I mean, our grades were kind of dictated on however far the teacher got, or the locally written test the teacher gave us. It was very intimate between the teacher and the student and what was taught and wasn't taught. And now we're applying this big, huge rubric of uncoverable material to a lot of students. So they're turned off when they get to college. They don't think, oh, I'm going to teach high school. Less and less of them are doing so, which is sad.
Other questions? Bueller? Anyone? Okay. Listen, thank you all so much for coming here. I have two requests for you. The first is if you go on Amazon, if you haven't already, and just leave them a 5-star review, it's really helpful. When you go on and you see, especially with a new author, you go on and you see them, if you see a lot of reviews, and it also triggers Amazon's algorithms a little bit to give them a higher ranking so it's more visible.
I want an honest, objective 5-star review.
And similarly, if you like what we're doing here at Elaine's, I'd really appreciate if you go on Google or Open Table or Yelp or wherever as you review restaurants and just give us a review too. We'd greatly appreciate that. So you have books for sale here and you're going to be signing.
Yep.
Okay, fantastic. All right. Well, thank you so much. Great job. Yep.
Thank you.